Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. It took a lot of talking and hand-wringing, but finally European leaders settled on a deal to bail out troubled EU economies. At 4 a.m. Brussels time, with exhausted diplomats slumped at their desks, the Eurozone's power players, Germany and France, explained the three-point plan. It aims to double the region's rescue fund, write off half of Greece's debt and cushion Europe's banks. Overnight, the number crunchers have been trying to understand exactly how the deal will work. Europe correspondent Rachel Brown reports.
The initial vital signs are good. European stock markets have soared overnight in a huge relief rally after the Eurozone accord eased concerns about the debt crisis sparking a fresh global recession. The German market has closed up 5.3%, the French up 6.3%. Even Italy, which threatens to be the next domino to fall, watched its market close 5.5% higher on the news of bank recapitalisation. Britain's Chancellor George Osborne says very good progress has been made, but much detail remains unsolved.
We have to keep up the pressure to get the details completed. They've started down the right road, now they have to finish the job.
He says the UK won't be directly paying into the Eurozone bailout fund. The accord includes a complex mechanism to boost this fund, the region's war chest, to more than $1.4 trillion. The head of France's central bank, Christian Noyer, doesn't think it matters that, for the moment, this money only exists on paper.
Of course, you cannot set up that sort of thing overnight, but I think the simple fact, I mean, it's the major objective was really to reassure markets that the backstop would be there. A backstop is not aiming at financing all public debt. It's really there to reassure markets.
Finding the money partly rests on attracting big investors. The head of the fund, Klaus Redling, will visit Beijing tomorrow as part of the mission to persuade China, Brazil and other top emerging economies to help out. China's state news agency, however, is reporting Europe needs to take responsibility and can't rely on Good Samaritans to bail out the Eurozone. David Buick from BGC Partners doesn't think Good Samaritan status will be enough for China.
If he thinks he's going to persuade the Chinese government, Hu Jintao, to actually step up to the plate and put some money in, I venture to suggest that's a big ask, because China have already got their problems, and I've never known China do something for nothing, so there'll be a sting in that tail for sure.
Dr. Tian Liu from China's Economist Intelligence Unit says Europe is China's largest export destination, so it can't afford a Eurozone collapse. However, she says it's too risky for China to act alone.
Plus, it needs to be assured that the money would be safe. Chances are China will not just jump out as a single actor to help bail out Europe. But most likely what's going to happen is that China would join the other countries, most likely to join a IMF package as a collective action to bail out Europe.
Tom Nuttall, the deputy editor of The Economist magazine, sees Europe's rescue plan as somewhat of a mirage.
The last time that they attempted to put together a so-called comprehensive solution to this problem, which was back in July, the July the 21st deal, markets reacted positively then for a few days. Then when they started to look at the details, it all began to unravel. That's when the markets began to attack Italian and Spanish debt, and the European Central Bank had to step in and provide liquidity funding. Now the danger is that we will see something similar start to happen again.
The Economist's Tom Nuttall ending that report from Rachel Brown in London. First, it was the young soldier Gilad Shalit who was released by his captors. Now another Israeli has been released in a deal that secures his freedom in exchange for the release of prisoners. Ilan Grapel, a law student, was jailed in Egypt for more than 4 months over accusations that he was a spy. Middle East correspondent Anne Barker reports.
Ilan Grapel went to Cairo in June to do voluntary legal work with an aid organisation. He was arrested by Egyptian military authorities who alleged he was an Israeli spy who'd helped to foment the recent uprising on behalf of Israel's spy agency Mossad. They even accused him of planning attacks on police stations. The 27-year-old freely admitted his Israeli background. As a dual national, he'd lived for a while in Israel and even fought in the last war against Lebanon. But his mother, Irene, told the CBS network the allegations were ridiculous.
He certainly had nothing to do with fomenting the revolution against Mubarak, firebombing police stations.
Those are some of the things that have been alleged?
Yes. Yes.
Even many Egyptians were sceptical that Ilan Grapel was an Israeli spy, especially given he'd travelled to Egypt under his own name and even posted photographs of himself in an Israeli military uniform onto his Facebook page. His sister Michal says he's only interested in completing his studies.
I think that he just wanted to get his master's degree and then he would decide what he was going to do.
Nevertheless, it's taken 4 months of negotiations between Israel and Egypt to secure Ilan Grapel's release. The deal was reached just after the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was freed from 5 years of captivity in Gaza. His freedom came in exchange for the release of 1,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. But this time Israel has released 25 Egyptians, mostly drug and weapons smugglers or illegal immigrants. And yet many Israelis have made the point that Egypt, a supposedly sovereign, friendly nation that acted as the neutral arbiter in the deal for Gilad Shalit's release, has now itself effectively held an Israeli hostage to secure its own citizens' freedom from Israeli jails. If Ilan Grapel is innocent, his freedom should come with no strings attached. And many Israelis, like right-wing MP Arya Eldad, are angry that the Israeli government has stooped to negotiate on what they say are clearly trumped-up charges. Israel has lost all rational boundaries, he says. Tomorrow, Turkey will take an Israeli tourist, arrest him, accuse him of helping the Kurdish underground, and demand 1,000 terrorists in return. Everyone in the Middle East has now learned that Israel is willing to give. Ilan Grapel's arrest has also heightened concerns in Israel about deteriorating relations with Egypt since Hosni Mubarak's regime was ousted in February, relations that many fear could collapse altogether once a new Egyptian government is elected. This is Anne Barker in Jerusalem for AM.
In the words of a former US president, it is mission accomplished. In this case, it is true. NATO's military action against Libya is now officially at an end and deemed to be successful. Libya's dictator is gone and there are hopes democracy will flourish. North America correspondent Jane Cowan reports.
After 7 months, a turbulent chapter of Libya's history closed within a matter of minutes in New York.
The draft resolution has been adopted unanimously. The meeting is adjourned.
The Security Council voted to cancel its mandate for international military action despite a request from Libya's interim government to wait until it had assessed the security situation and the ability to secure its borders. But Britain hailed the development, saying it was another sign Libya had entered a new era. The US ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, spoke after the vote.
We have the prospect for a free and inclusive Libya in which the aspirations of the Libyan people can finally be realised in the wake of the transition that's underway.
But Susan Rice also sounded a cautionary note, expressing concern about the new government's approach to human rights.
We're very concerned that as we move forward, that the authorities make maximum effort to swiftly form an inclusive government that incorporates all aspects of Libyan society and in which the rights of all Libyan people are fully and thoroughly respected, regardless of their gender, their religion, their region of origin, etc.
In Benghazi, Libya's new leaders moved to reassure the international community, promising human rights violations wouldn't be tolerated. In a sharp break with their previous insistence, Muammar Gaddafi was caught in the crossfire of his own loyalists. They vowed to bring the former leader's killers to justice. The vice chairman of the ruling National Transitional Council, Abdel Hafiz Goga, also pledged that Gaddafi's fugitive son, Saif al-Islam, who's been on the run since the time his father met a grisly death, but who's indicated he's ready to surrender to justice, will be tried properly if he's caught. There's no information on Saif al-Islam, he says, but if he is captured, he'll be tried internally, and if he flees to neighbouring countries, he'll be handed over to the International Criminal Court, and this will be against his will, because there's been an international warrant issued against him. It's unlikely NATO will play a major role in post-conflict Libya. The alliance's Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says the UN vote means the alliance has firm ground for ending its operations as decided earlier. If requested, he says the alliance could assist the Libyan government in the transformation to democracy, particularly in the area of defence and security reforms. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
And you're listening to AM around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's just gone 20 minutes past seven. The Queen will officially open the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting this morning, but behind the scenes there is disquiet among some members about the lack of will to reform the organisation. The Eminent Persons Group recommendations to set up a Commissioner for Democracy, Human Rights and the Rule of Law have received scant support. Regardless, the Secretary-General and Australia's Prime Minister are talking up the prospects of the Perth Conference being a landmark event. From Perth, Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane.
Details about the opening ceremony for the 21st Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting are still secret. So too are the findings of the so-called Eminent Persons Group, the panel of nine outsiders charged with making recommendations to reform the Commonwealth. Some countries and lobby groups are unhappy the report's been kept under wraps, claiming CHOGM's preparing to water down the findings. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague strongly put the case for full transparency before a public forum last night.
We've been discussing the recommendations of the Eminent Persons Group, recommendations which, as I was saying in the earlier meeting, I think should have been published in advance for all of you and other people to comment on in advance of the meeting.
But the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, Carmela Pashad Bisesa, argues the organisation is following proper procedure.
I'm a lawyer, now a head of government. It was in 2009 that the heads of government commissioned an EPG report. And therefore, it was my respectful view that before the report be released publicly, that the heads of government should receive it.
It's known the group's recommended a Charter of Commonwealth Principles and a Commissioner for Democracy, Human Rights and the Rule of Law. Again, William Hague.
The case for reinvigorating the Commonwealth is abundantly clear, and Britain wholeheartedly supports the recommendations of the EPG. In particular, we welcome their focus on promoting the values of the Commonwealth. The modern Commonwealth has always been an association based on strong values. We also support recommendations to institute a Commonwealth Commissioner for Democracy, Rule of Law and Human Rights. This is a controversial recommendation.
AM's been told only six or so nations favour the idea of a commissioner. The Prime Minister was asked about the wavering support. So far, Julia Gillard's declined to say where Australia stands.
I'm not going to speculate as to what may emerge in discussions between leaders.
The Commonwealth Secretary-General, Carmela Sharma.
It's not enough to point to a train wreck. Everybody can see that. You have to take an interest when the wagons are wobbling on the rail lines.
But Mr. Sharma concedes decisions to reform the organisation must be agreed to by all parties.
You've heard one person's view, which you must respect, of course. Then there are views of 54 member states of the Commonwealth that have to be taken into account in going forward on an important decision like this. But we are about to embark on what I'm convinced will be a landmark Perth CHOGM.
And we'll know if that's the case on Sunday.
Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane. Rowdy scenes are expected at Qantas's annual general meeting to be held in Sydney today. The airline is in dispute with its pilots, ground staff and engineers over pay and conditions, as well as the outsourcing of jobs overseas. And the unions representing these workers have all vowed to make their presence felt at the meeting. At airports across the country today, ground staff will take industrial action. The premiers of Victoria and New South Wales are calling on the Prime Minister to intervene to end the dispute. Here's Michael Edwards.
It's set to be a torrid day for Qantas's management and its passengers. The Qantas board can expect a hostile reception from unions at the company's annual general meeting, and passengers face more delays as ground staff walk off the job for a series of rolling stop work meetings. Mick Pieri from the Transport Workers Union says the campaign will continue until Qantas can assure his members that their jobs won't be outsourced to the cheapest bidder.
My problem is they want to outsource here, and what I mean by outsourcing is that there'll be nobody, there'll be labour hire people being employed instead of Qantas workers on a cheaper rate, 20% cheaper from my understanding.
Qantas says the union is carrying out its campaign at the expense of air travellers. The airline spokesman is Justin Kelly.
Unfortunately, there will be around 70 domestic flights which will be delayed today, and the biggest disruption will last around 70 minutes, and that is going to have a direct impact all day of about 10,000 passengers.
Qantas remains at an impasse with its ground staff, pilots and engineers. Justin Kelly says the situation won't improve until the unions stop making unreasonable demands.
Well, negotiations with all three unions, the Transport Workers Union, the pilots and the licensed engineers, unfortunately have stalled. We're not making a lot of progress at all, and we again call on the three unions to remove their unrealistic claims from current negotiations.
With no end in sight, the premiers of Australia's two most populous states, New South Wales and Victoria, have called on the Prime Minister to intervene to end the dispute. The New South Wales Premier, Barry O'Farrell, and his Victorian counterpart, Ted Baillieu, have written to Julia Gillard, outlining their concerns about the economic impact of the situation. They're worried about its effects on the tourism and aviation sectors, as well as investor confidence and productivity growth. Premiers O'Farrell and Baillieu want the Prime Minister to use her powers under the Fair Work Act to intervene. The unions involved are sceptical as to why the premiers have written the letter. Steve Pervenis is the Federal Secretary of the Australian Licensed Engineers Association.
Qantas have called upon all of their friends in the last few weeks to come to their aid to try and convince the government to step in. We've had all of the heads of the tourism bodies, now a few state premiers. I think it would be wise for some of those people to actually give us a call, and we can give them some information that may shed some light onto the subject.
In a statement, a spokesman for the Prime Minister dismissed the Premier's letter as a media stunt. However, the statement said the government will continue to monitor the situation and the parties involved should be aware that the government can intervene.
Michael Edwards. One in six Australians are likely to suffer a stroke in their lifetime, but depending where they live, they may not survive, then again, they may not. A national audit of stroke care has revealed the chance of survival rates varies dramatically depending on what hospital and in what state or territory you're admitted. The Stroke Foundation says hundreds more lives could be saved if hospitals knew how to administer clot-busting drugs and how to reorganise their existing resources. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
Stroke is Australia's second greatest cause of death and a massive contributor to adult disabilities. But a nationwide survey taking in 188 hospitals has found major flaws with how stroke care is delivered, and that depends on where you live. The National Stroke Foundation's chief executive is Dr. Erin Laylor.
The survey's demonstrated that access to stroke care in Australia is really very poor, and there's great variation across the country. One of the most important treatments that someone who's had a stroke can receive is care on a stroke unit. And what we found in this report, that only 58% of Australians are receiving stroke unit care. And this varied from as low as 38% in Western Australia to 77% in Tasmania. We also know that if we can increase access to stroke unit care, we could see as many as around 700 lives that are saved from death and disability from stroke.
So what is it exactly that hospitals need to be delivering best care services?
There are a series of systems that they need in place, and some of those are about getting patients in quickly and seeing them in time to receive clot-busting drugs that must be given within the first 4.5 hours. So that's arrangements with ambulance and emergency department protocols. Having a stroke unit is recommended in every hospital that admits more than 100 patients. In Australia, there's 81 of those hospitals, and 16 of them don't have stroke units in place.
Have you got any idea of how much that would cost?
Stroke unit care is partly about resources, and we would certainly argue that we need to see more resources in place to ensure that people get access to best practice care. But it's not just about resources. Often stroke unit care is about reorganising existing resources and ensuring that staff who work on the stroke team have access to training and professional development that ensures that their skills remain specialised.
The Foundation recommends where stroke units can't be economically justified, systems should be put in place so patients can get to a hospital with a stroke unit within 4 hours. This gives them the greatest chance of making it home alive.
Bronwyn Herbert reporting. As we mentioned earlier, the rescue deal for debt-laden Eurozone economy sparked a rally on global share markets. Exchanges in London and Frankfurt surged 5%, while Paris closed 6% higher. Wall Street rose sharply. A greater appetite for risk has pushed the Aussie dollar higher. It's now buying just over 107 US cents. So in New York, the Dow Jones closed up 340 points. The Nasdaq up 88. In London, the FTSE finished the day up 161 points. The dollar against the euro, 75.5 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley, and that's AM for today.